Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan's home foreclosure rate is falling. Our state certainly no longer number one in foreclosures in the country. We find out why on today's show. And then Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry joins us later this hour to take a look at just how our lawmakers are spending their summer recess. But first, it's Thursday, and that means it's time to turn to Daniel Howes, columnist at the Detroit News. Hello, Daniel.
Hey, Cindy, how are you?
Good, good. Today, you're looking at Detroit Emergency Manager Kevin Orr and the big meetings this week with the city's creditors and bondholders. So I want to start out, and I want to read a bit from your column today in the Detroit News. Here's what you wrote. As Orr's week of meetings with creditors and pension funds unspools and Detroit slouches closer to an historic Chapter 9 bankruptcy filing, the gulf separating the financial imperatives of the city's creditors and the political realities of its predicament is unmistakable and probably unbridgeable. So, Daniel, I hear a kind of sour note this week. Explain for us what's going on between Orr and the creditors that has you looking at the glass half empty.
Well, Kevin Orr's restructuring teams are meeting with, in various sets of meetings with both creditors, bondholders, as well as pension funds to kind of lay out what their offer is. As it's been described to me this week by one of the lawyers involved in this, it's really not so much a negotiation so much as it is an exchange or an open discussion about what they need to do. But there's not a lot of wiggle room here, and I think that's really the bottom line. Some people are approaching this as if Kevin Orr's got more money to play with than he actually does. In Chapter 9, it's all about whether a city has cash flow or doesn't have cash flow. It's not about whether it owns assets in an art museum, for example, or a piece of real estate in the middle of the Detroit River. It's really, is it cash flow insolvent or is it not? And his argument is, we're insolvent, there's no more money, we can't raise taxes, This is what you're going to get. So that's not really so much a negotiation in the classic sense of the word.
Now, you're arguing in your piece creditors are really not buying Orr's what you call deadbeat defense for Detroit, and nor should they, that they aren't in the charity business. But if that's the case, how does Detroit move forward to right its financial ship?
Well, I think that's why I think bankruptcy is increasingly likely. My reading of this and talking to experts about it, including in one interview with Kevin Orr, is that the powers that he has as emergency manager are turbocharged under Chapter 9. Where the process really is weighted in favor of, in this case, the city or the debtor. In Chapter 11, which people are more familiar with in the business world, it's really a balancing act between the company that's going into bankruptcy, its needs, and what it's going to look like on the other side, and the financial obligations to creditors, et cetera, et cetera. That's not so much the case in Chapter 9. It's all about fixing the financial problems of the municipality. And most of the power resides with the debtor. In this case, it would be Kevin Orr. And as long as the judge, he can convince a judge that there are no other options for Detroit, that's how you move forward. And I think a lot of the people involved in this know this. We have a story on our front page today, a news story, where pension officials are accusing Kevin Orr of basically a dog and pony show, that he has no intention of, quote, negotiating, that he's going to take this thing into Chapter 9. And I think they know that once they get into Chapter 9, they don't have a lot of options, and he can pretty much do whatever he can convince a judge that he needs to do.
So is his position between a rock and a hard place as he's trying to show creditors just how bad things are, and then the creditors are saying, okay, but I'm special. What's in it for me?
Exactly.
How do you get around that?
I don't think you really do. The other side of this coin is that those of us that have been a lot closer to Detroit for a much longer period of time have seen this train wreck developing for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And you look at these lenders of various classes of lenders, and you want to say to these people, what are you thinking? I mean, this has been the sickest major city in America for, you know, a generation or more, probably two generations. And yet they've either loaned the city money, or they've bought bonds in the city and hold municipal bonds with the assumption that, oh, the city will continue to raise taxes. Well, did they bother to look at the tax load that Detroit was carrying? Did they understand that it's at its statutory limit, that the state of Michigan, the laws in the state of Michigan, won't allow it to raise any more taxes, barring an act of the legislature? And I think part of what Kevin Orr's argument to some of these people is, you should have been paying closer attention. And their argument back to him is, well, no, you're breaking the rules. Mm. Well, in some senses, he really isn't breaking the rules. These are unsecured creditors, and he says, we can't raise taxes. In fact, they want to cut taxes. So, I mean, I think the reason that they don't want to bargain with him is because I think in part they don't want to set any kind of precedent. If you're a municipal lender or of some kind, you get into a real difficult position if all of a sudden you start taking 10 cents on the dollar from Detroit and then you have other distressed municipalities that try to go down the same road.
Do you see any upside for Kevin Orr as this week unfolded? The bus tour that didn't happen, which apparently was the idea of Kenneth Buchfire, mm-hmm. who's the Detroit native and New York investment banker who thought it would be, he's the city's lead financial advisor. Let's show him how bad things are. So that was his thing. It got public. It went away. But the fact that Kevin Orr appears to be putting services to residents first over forking over money to creditors, does that kind of put a damper on the critics who say he's only here to keep banks and money interests happy?
Well, I think people that make that charge aren't really looking at the that's just empty rhetoric. I don't think they're really looking at his proposal. They're not looking at who's taking a haircut. I mean, are some of these bondholders insured by bond insurers? Yeah, they are. That's the way the system works. But the bond insurers are the people who stand to lose a lot. No, I think he's focusing. I mean, look, Detroit has been run for a very, very long time for its employees and the political structure, not for the residents, mm-hmm. not for the businesses, not for people like me who pay taxes, don't live in the city, but go down there and have to pay taxes in the city. It's been run for the unions, the demands of the pension funds, the political class, the members of city council who wear tiaras and sing songs and do all sorts of other silliness and have presided over the collapse of a once great American city. And I think what he's doing is trying to turn that on its head. And the other group you could add into that is it was run for the lending community. Because they continued to get their money. They continued to get paid until they got to a point where it wasn't going to happen anymore. And I think what Kevin Orr is doing is saying, wait a minute, we've got to arrest the decline, got to provide better services, and have a better environment that's more welcoming for people to move in back into this city, for businesses to continue to invest. And I think his strategy probably makes a lot of sense. Whether he's going to be able to pull it off or not in the time frame that he is pushing is another thing, because there's also a political component here, Cynthia.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Governor Rick Snyder, who's Kevin Orr's boss, is going to be running for re-election, by all accounts, by this time next year. They need to show results. And those results are not cutting a deal with a bunch of lenders that nobody knows who they are. It's getting the lights on. It's getting cops responding more quickly. It's getting EMS to come when people call 911.
Daniel House, columnist at the Detroit News, our Thursday check-in. Thanks so much, Daniel.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Michigan's home foreclosure rate is tumbling. During the Great Recession, Michigan's foreclosure rate was among the nation's highest and at times the highest in the nation. Today, Michigan ranks 15th. Darren Bloomquist is with Realty Track. And Darren, just what's behind this slowdown in foreclosures?
You know, I think that Michigan was one of the first states that we saw to go down this path of higher foreclosures, and now it's leading the charge out of the foreclosure crisis as well. Because I think the fundamental reason that this is happening is that the state has been able to work more quickly through the bad loans that really triggered the foreclosure crisis more quickly than some other states. Michigan has a foreclosure process that on average takes about 307 days, which may sound like a long time, but that's well below the national average. The national average is 526 days to complete a foreclosure. So Michigan has worked through the foreclosures more quickly, and the bad loans that were really at the root of this housing crisis over the last 7 years have either already been foreclosed on in Michigan, or the homeowners have gotten a loan modification or refinanced or even sold their property as a short sale in many cases for the bulk of those bad loans.
Now, you have said, Darren, that this doesn't mean there aren't still problems with the housing market in our state, but I like your term, we have stopped the bleeding. What challenges still remain?
Yes, I think there's certainly some challenges that remain. One of those is that there's still a lot of homeowners who are underwater on their mortgages. In Michigan, we're showing 37% of homeowners with a mortgage in Michigan owe more than the property is worth. Now, the rising home prices that we're seeing in recent months are going to help those people get out of that position, but it's going to take some time. That is the fourth highest, by the way, nationwide, and behind Nevada and Florida are above Michigan in terms of that underwater. So that's one of the big challenges, is until those homeowners have positive equity in their homes, you still have a big segment of the market that really can't participate in buying and selling real estate. They're kind of stuck in their homes. And then the other challenge I think that's facing Michigan is still a lot of homes that have already been foreclosed but are just sitting there and have not yet been sold by the banks. And so that's another challenge going forward.
But overall, if you owned a home in Michigan and you've been worried about whether it's being underwater or losing your home to foreclosure, does this mean you can breathe a little easier?
It does. I think that that if you've been able to stick it out this long, that we're seeing home prices rise at very quick paces and at a very quick pace in Michigan, and there's a lot of room for growth, honestly, with the prices there. So I think that you can breathe a little easier and look forward to regaining that equity in your home, hopefully in the next couple of years, even if you are still underwater.
That was Darren Blomquist of Realty Track. He joined us from their offices in California. Still to come, just what are your lawmakers up to on their summer recess? Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry joins us to answer that question in just 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you think back and look at the school classes that meant the most to you, chances are the course that had the most impact was one that translated into real-world experiences or came from real-world experiences. Well, what could be more real-world than teaching lessons learned in climbing Mount Everest? Scott DeRue teaches at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. He directs the Emerging Leaders Program and co-directs the Ross Leadership Initiative, so he is all about teaching leadership and team development. Well, his students will be getting lessons in leadership and teamwork learned the hard way, because this past May, Scott DeRue climbed to the summit of Mount Everest. Scott joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you, Cindy.
All right, start by telling us, what drove you to do this? It's not your everyday accomplishment.
That's a question that I often get, is why do you even go climb Mount Everest? And the best answer I can give you is George Mallory was one of the first to attempt Everest, and he died there in 1924. And he said, to understand and to struggle. And you can't have the understanding without the struggle. And for me, Everest was a journey of self-understanding in many ways, a way to push myself, challenge myself, and to learn about what I can do. And it was really a journey of self-discovery in many ways.
Now, had you been climbing through your life, or was this something where you kind of were new at this and decided to plunge into the deep end?
You do not want to make Everest your first rodeo. So I started climbing back in 2007. And I started with Kilimanjaro in Africa. And then as you progress in climbing, what you learn is the mountains just keep getting bigger and bigger and taller and taller. And so I've been climbing since then, about one big mountain per year. And Everest was on the list for this year.
And I know that at the Ross School of Business, they've been using computer simulations to say, well, this is what it might be like as a team climbs Everest. How did that measure up to the real thing?
It's actually a really close proxy for the real experience. At Ross, we pride ourselves on action-based learning. Mm-hmm. We do that in a number of ways. The simulations are one. The online simulation that we use really challenges students in a couple of different ways. One is, how do you align goals in teams? Right? You may have your agenda. I may have my agenda.
Yeah.
How do we align those so that we can work effectively together? It also challenges students on how to communicate and share information in ways that, when you have an area of expertise and I have an area of expertise, we actually are communicating in such a way that we can combine those in order to be effective. If you think about organizations, we often break down along functional silos. Marketing can't talk to finance, marketing and operations, sales and so forth.
Absolutely. And first shift doesn't talk to the second shift. Yeah, I've seen it.
Exactly. And so the simulation really challenges students in that way. On Everest, we experience the same thing. There are different goals. Everybody wants to make the summit, mm-hmm. generally, but people have different priorities or importance around safety, around other goals they may have while they're there. And you see those agendas play out, and it's key that we align those so that we can work effectively as a team, because nobody's going to climb that mountain solo.
And that's what I was wondering. So you were part of a team. Nobody goes solo.
Well, some people do, but they're a rare breed.
Okay.
We started with 12 team members. We had four guides, professional guides from Alpine Ascents International, which is considered probably the best guiding company in the world, mm-hmm. and around 30 to 35 Sherpa locals who every year this is their job, is to help people like me climb the mountain. And none of us really knew each other before we started.
So getting to the top. Certainly you'd been training, you'd been climbing other mountains and leading up to this over the last 6 years. How did the reality match with what you thought it would be like?
It was everything that I hoped for and much more. I didn't really know what to expect in terms of the risk or the danger as much. Everest, unlike many of the other mountains we climb, you're exposed in ways that are hard to replicate on other mountains, meaning that if you fall, bad things happen, right?
Well, over 200 people have died trying to climb Everest, so yeah.
Yeah, that was hard to predict, and that was one of the questions that I had. I had anxieties going in. Am I fit enough? Am I competent enough, skilled enough? How am I going to react to those dangers? And so that was a big uncertainty. In terms of expectations around how we would work together as a team, I'd climbed with Alpine Ascents before. I knew how competent and proficient they were as guides. And so I had full confidence that we would develop into a team and work effectively together. And that played out.
That played out. So that's the kind of lesson you can bring back to your students. But before we talk about that, tell me about the moment you got to the summit.
It's actually quite anticlimactic. So you've been training I trained specifically for this mountain for 9 months. You've been working for years to build up to it. Mm-hmm. And you're there for 2 months. Mm-hmm. And you get to the summit, and what you quickly realize is you're only halfway home. And so when we got there, it's a very joyous occasion, lots of hugs and high fives.
Photographs.
Everybody's trying to get their picture of this, their summit picture. But one of the first things I said to one of my teammates was, we're only halfway there. We have to get down. Ed Viesters, who's a famous climber, has a really famous saying in the mountaineering community, which is getting to the top is optional. Getting down is mandatory. And those 200 deaths, for example, that you mentioned on Everest and most of the accidents, they don't occur on the way up. They occur on the way down because people relax. It's actually more dangerous going down. You can see the danger. That was one of the eye-opening things for me, is I could actually see how steep it was, whereas when you're going up in the dark, it doesn't look that steep.
Oh, okay.
So it's anticlimactic for that reason, but a very joyous occasion.
So taking that trip back down, were there any terrifying moments?
There were. There were a couple. One of my team members on the steepest part, it's called the Lhotse Face. It's probably a 50 to 60 degree slope made of ice. And he fell. He was right in front of me, and he fell. And in the process of falling, he took out one of our guides. So they were both falling. And fortunately, I'd say maybe 100 feet after falling, an anchor stopped them. And then shortly after Martin getting to his feet and us getting back going down the mountain, one of his most important pieces of equipment, his crampon, which are the spikes on your boots, mm-hmm. fell off. And this is where you really learn the power of a team. And this is one of those lessons we'll certainly bring back to the classroom. no guides were available because of where we were on the mountain. And so we as team members, you know, in relative terms, novices compared to the professionals, mm-hmm. we had to mobilize and work together to help him put back on his crampon. Otherwise, there's no way he's getting down that mountain.
So take that whole experience, Scott Giroux, and as you're talking to your students now, when they come back in the fall, what kind of leadership and team development lessons do you hope they take away from your excursion?
The first thing that I hope they take away is the power of trust and teamwork. Our students get to Ross. We're one of the best schools in the world. Mm-hmm. They get to Ross because they're great individual contributors. If you give them any task, they can perform it excellent. What they have to realize is that as they move forward in their career, they can't do everything alone. They have to learn to rely on others and to build effective teams. That's the first lesson. And it sounds simple, but it's fundamental.
Because when they go into some company, it won't be the atmosphere at the Ross School of Business. It'll be the real world with all its warts and all its challenges, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And we can simulate those to the best of our ability at Ross, mm-hmm. But it's nothing like the real world, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why we try and commit to action-based learning where we put our students in the real world as much mm-hmm. as possible and then simulate what we can't.
Okay.
The second thing I hope they take away is the importance of goal alignment early in the team process. In every organization, individuals have their own personal agendas. At the same time, the team, the company has its agenda, its goals, mm-hmm. and those don't always align. And what we're trying to do is develop leaders who understand those tensions and have the skills to align people along a collective shared goal so that we can achieve. The third thing I hope they take away, a set of skills about how to communicate and facilitate information sharing in teams so that when your expertise is needed, it's incorporated effectively. And when my expertise is needed, it's incorporated effectively. Because all too often in organizations, that's where we see the communication breakdowns occur.
Okay. And what now? You've climbed Mount Everest, so you can't climb a taller mountain. What's next for you as far as your own personal challenges?
The first personal challenge is I'm getting married in September.
Well.
not that that's a challenge, but it is.
It's a big moment in your life.
It is a summit yes, that I am very much looking forward to.
So 2013 is going to be a year that Scott Giroux remembers for a long time.
It is shaping up to be one of the best years of my life yeah. for sure. The next, I think, challenge in this similar vein would be I think I'm going to go after what's called the Four Deserts. There are four deserts around the world, and each one is about a 150-mile challenge where you spend 7 days working across those 150 miles. My goal is just to finish, but I think that's probably going to be the next challenge.
That's quite the challenge. Scott Giroux teaches leadership and team development at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan, and you can learn more about his views on leadership and team development. You can go to his website, scottgiroux.com. That's Scott, ScottDeRue.com. Pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much for sharing your story with us, Scott.
Thank you for having me.
And speaking of travels, we turn now to one man from Midland. Peter Sinclair touched down in Greenland on the Greenland ice sheet, to be exact. He did it earlier this week. Peter's a videographer. He and his camera are joining a team of scientists and Rolling Stone writer Bill McKibben for this trip. They believe Greenland is where global warming and the soot and pollution we're pumping into the atmosphere is eating away at the glaciers. The team wants to do more research into this glacial melting, and Peter Sinclair is going to record their efforts. I sat down with Peter before he left Michigan and asked him just where the significance of this project's name, Dark Snow, came from.
Well, the scientific leader of the team, Dr. Jason Box, published a paper about a year ago noting that the Greenland ice sheet has been getting progressively darker over the last decade. And he predicted that if that continued, that we would see a major melt event over the entire surface of Greenland. And that event, in fact, occurred about 4 weeks after his paper was published. And Dr. Box's concern is that the increase in wildfires around North America in particular may be depositing more larger amounts of soot, darkening that ice sheet and speeding the melting process.
Oh, that makes sense. Dark stuff is going to attract the sun and melt faster. And as you're there this summer and you with Dr. Box and his team, what will you actually be doing? What are you going to be recording and what will you be studying?
Well, we have some PhDs coming with us whose expertise is in sampling the snow, getting it back to the lab, and then they'll have the tools to actually identify if indeed soot is one of the key darkening agents that we're looking at. They'll be able to tell where that's from and trace it back and make the connection to the wildfires.
Hmm.
There are other agents that do darken the ice sheet, natural agents like ocean spray and dust from deserts and things like that. So there's a little bit of detective work that's going to be involved.
And Peter, you were invited to join this excursion because of your YouTube channel, the Climate Denial Croc of the Week. How did you start curating these videos? What was your goal?
I have a long-term involvement in issues of environment and energy and professionally an expertise in graphic arts, animation, and videography. About 6 or 7 years ago, I just became just incensed and absolutely outraged by the amount of misinformation that I was seeing, especially on the Internet. Mm. And I felt it was time to start using the Internet tools to really push back against the disinformation with real information from the primary literature and from the actual boots-on-the-ground scientists who are doing the research. So I identified what I call the climate crocs, and these are maybe 20 or 30 little crunchy nuggets of disinformation that Rush Limbaugh can say in about 15 seconds, but then it takes an hour and a half for an honest scientist to disentangle them.
Mm.
So my challenge was to see if I can, in 5 or 6 or 8 minutes, make a video that is punchy, entertaining, and factual, and basically lays these things to rest. There are more than 100 of these now. And scientists have been writing me from all over the world telling me they're using them in classes, they're sharing them with colleagues, and they're starting to invite me on expeditions. Last summer I was up in the Cascades on glaciers up there. I've been speaking to scientists at scientific meetings about better communication, and that was the reason that Dr. Box invited me to come up to Greenland.
Peter, it makes me wonder, just what lengths do activists have to go to grab the public attention to environmental issues? Why is it no longer enough to just write about an issue and publish something?
Wow. Well, that's a $1 million question. People are stressed and people are pulled in 100 different competing directions, and climate change is one of the most fiendishly difficult issues that we've ever had to deal with because it is creeping up on us so slowly, and a lot of people still haven't figured out the difference between climate and weather. And so if we have a cool spell, people will say, well, global warming is over.
I have heard that. I have heard people say that. What global warming?
Right, exactly. It takes a lot of education and repetition, and it takes a lot of media outreach to get to people where they are. Which is more and more on the Internet, and that's why I've focused on social media.
And that was Peter Sinclair, a Michigan videographer who just joined a team that includes Rolling Stone writer Bill McKibben. They're on the Greenland ice sheet to document the effects of pollution and soot on the glaciers of Greenland. Just what are your lawmakers up to over their summer recess? Then we find out about one very unique Michigan-Ohio State rivalry. That story's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, here's a question. What are your summer vacation plans? For many in Michigan, it could mean time at the cottage or a beach up north. But what if you're a lawmaker, either state or federal? What should summer vacation mean? Time to take a break? Time to be in your district and take the pulse of voters, hear their concerns? Let's talk about summer vacation, summer recess for members of Congress and the state legislature. Joining us is Todd Spangler, the D.C.-based reporter for the Detroit Free Press. And looking at Lansing, we have Jack Lesenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst. Todd, let's start with Congress, which officially, I guess you could say, is never on vacation. Is that right?
That's right. They have congressional work periods or district work periods. They mix work in with other stuff, I guess, but, you know, they do have time away. So they're certainly, lately, they've been spending a lot of time away from D.C.
With things hanging, and that's certainly something voters have noticed. What are some of the must-see stops that members of Congress should be making? Should they be marching those parades and shaking hands at coffee shops?
Absolutely. I think that anybody who doesn't get out there the way that, for instance, Gary Peters, who represents Detroit, was out last week marching in parades all over his district. He's running for U.S. Senate as well. I mean, you have to get out and do that, or you run the risk of being accused of being too insular, of being too Washington, of not getting out and talking to your constituents.
I also think they like it. I mean, both the Levins march in our little Huntington Woods parade every fall, and Sander Levin, the congressman, could get reelected if he went to Brazil for 2 years. And, of course, Carl is now retiring, but they still show up for the parades, and I think they like that sort of thing.
Especially, I think, those old-timers, if you will, get that you really do need to be out there and be seen.
Well, I think that's absolutely part of why they could go to Brazil now after so long and do that. I mean, they've built up so much goodwill in their districts. And, of course, their districts have been built in a certain kind of way that just from a partisan standpoint, they could run and win largely because of how those districts are built. They don't all do that, obviously. I mean, you know, Carl was in Turkey with Senator King from Maine last week and came back to talk about Syria. And he went to Turkey and Jordan to see refugees. So, it's not all, running around and being in parades.
But and it's also, I think, important to note that districts are vastly different in size. You take Dan Benishek, who represents the entire Upper Peninsula and a big chunk of the lower, they have to drive all over creation. It's one of the biggest districts east of the Mississippi, and so it's a lot harder for some of them to run around and see constituents, which they have to do, than others.
And where does the money come to cover that? Is that out of his pocket, or does he get a travel allowance? Because you're right, that's a lot of driving.
Well, he does get a travel allowance, and he can use some money from the office to travel around that district. And of course, he has a campaign fund if it's campaign related as well. But Jack's absolutely right, which is why when Congressman Benishek was running for that seat, it was a hotly contested one because there was a realization that whoever the incumbent in that seat is going to be is going to have a real natural advantage. It's just too hard for somebody from one place or another to hit all those markets and really get a groundswell of support to beat somebody who's already in office.
Jack, looking at the state level and contrasting it with the folks in Congress, is there a difference in just their workday and the workload? Is it easier in the state compared to D.C.?
Well, there are times of frenetic activity in the state legislature, but yes, it is easier, and there's been some eyebrows raised about how much they actually do work. There was one headline that said the Michigan Senate was going on vacation from having a vacation, and I think they vary more widely. Some of them indeed spend a lot of time talking to constituents and doing constituent services. Some of them don't. I would think that more than half of them have other jobs. They go and do their other jobs. My favorite story is this was not a legislator. This was a school board member named Lonnie Bates, who was discovered billing the city to go to a conference in Morocco. He never actually went to the conference. He flew first class and went to a resort. And he was discovered doing this by a reporter. And he said, well, he thought that it was more important for the school kids of Detroit to see that a school board member could be a big man.
Remember that.
Yes, he eventually went to prison for 33 months, got out, was elected to Detroit City Council, and was convicted again of something else. So that's a bizarre exception. But a lot of them, I think to be sure, a lot of these legislators do some time, spend some time with constituents, but not all that much time.
Well, this business of state reps and senators actually having other jobs, is that something that's become a bigger factor in these days of term limits as compared with years past?
Yes. In fact, if you give somebody a job and say, okay, you can have this job for a maximum of 6 years and then never again, their last 2 years are going to be focused fairly intensely on looking for another job. Now, I think it's illegal, Todd, isn't it, for Congress people to do that? I don't think
Correct.
They can really
yeah.
have
that,
other
work. Yeah, that's right, Jack. I mean, if you're a member of Congress, you can't have another job. It is interesting on the state rep side, though, and I mean, in the state house side, how many people after term limits have gone on to get jobs in government, I mean, lobbying or you know, other sort of consulting jobs with government. That really, these people are not leaving to leave government after they're leaving. A lot of them are sticking around.
Well, they actually aren't working for government so much as they're working for organizations that lobby the government.
Right, yes. That's what I guess.
Yeah.
A particularly egregious example, I think, was State Representative Paul Opsahmer, who was head of the House Transportation Committee and did everything he could to block a new bridge from being built. And as soon as he left the legislature, went to work for Matty Maroon, who owns the Ambassador Bridge. Now, that even had some Republicans saying we ought to have some ethics rules or some legal rules against this, but no one's moved to do that.
The path is clear to do that.
Yes. Now, I think in federal government, correct me if I'm wrong, Todd, in some cases you have to wait a year, don't you?
Absolutely. You do have to wait. You have to wait at least a year. And that's why you have people like Bart Stupak, who used to be in Congressman Benishek's seat, who consulted, quote unquote, for a year, and then after that he could become a lobbyist. But they have to make a distinction. Did you actually lobby on a bill? Did you actually ask someone for their vote versus consulting, which may mean this is our strategy for trying to get attention for stuff. But yes, generally speaking, they have to wait a year before they become a quote unquote registered lobbyist.
So that allows it to pass the sniff test a little bit better.
So they say.
Do you think, I'm interested in the thoughts of both of you, do voters accept the fact that these lawmakers deserve some vacation, or do voters really think they should be on the job all year round, particularly when they break and there's issues still hanging?
Well, I got to say that there's whether voters feel one way or not is sort of difficult to read, because ultimately what ends up happening is that if you oppose the party in power, and the party in power is leaving with something undone, then, you know, you're going to hear a lot of, why are they leaving town when the immigration bill hasn't been done, or the budget isn't finalized, or the debt ceiling hasn't been raised? I mean, you hear a lot of that. A lot of that is geeked by members of the opposing party who are trying to make a political point. I think that, generally speaking, most voters would think people deserve some time off. It's only when something seems to be blowing up that they think, why aren't you there taking care of it? And quite frankly, there always seems to be something blowing up, depending on, you know, your political viewpoint on it.
And that's the case in Lansing as well, correct, Jack?
Oh, absolutely. I think the interesting thing about both the state representatives and people in Congress, if you ask the average voter's opinion of them, it's very, very low, but they vote to reelect their own person. I think there's a little more scrutiny in at the state level these days. But you know, to me, one of the most outrageous examples was a few years ago when, during a budget debate, it wasn't even vacation time, Dave Adjema, state representative from the Grand Rapids area, went sheep hunting in Siberia. He went to hunt wild sheep in Siberia, but he's faced no retribution from that at all, and is now a member of the Republican National Committee and has been going around causing controversy by anti-gay post on Facebook. But
yes,
the fact that some of them, I think it's important to note that they're not necessarily restricted to taking vacation when it's vacation. I suspect that if you or I, Cindy, yeah, went sheep hunting in Siberia in the middle of the work week, we might be in some trouble.
We might be out of a job.
That too.
What do you both expect lawmakers, both state and federal, are going to be hearing if they're standing in line at the coffee shop and a constituent would like to air a viewpoint or express a concern? What do you think some of the main issues and concerns will be that lawmakers are going to get an earful of?
Well, I certainly think from a federal viewpoint, you're still going to hear a lot about jobs. I mean, the economy has still not turned around job-wise as well as people would have liked it to. You're going to hear a lot about immigration. You're going to hear a lot about budgeting in general and the whole idea of, you know, did sequester do this, did sequester do that. You have to take more money out of government. You have to put more money into these services. I still think you hear that a lot.
I think it varies with the individual voter. I think that people like us three are sometimes, we're so plugged into the big picture that we don't see it from the ground level. And we see these major issues that we're talking about, but something very much else might want to be on voters' minds. I remember very many years ago when my hair was still dark, I did a story about agriculture policy that was supposed to be in the paper the next day, and a couple farmers were very interested in that. And then one called me indignantly and said, you told me the story was going to be in the paper, and it wasn't. And I said, well, sir, the president was shot today. And he didn't think that was an excuse.
Wow.
So you just don't, you know, people are interested in what they're interested in.
Todd Spangler, Free Press reporter in Washington and Michigan Radio's political analyst, Jack Lessenberry. Great talking with you. Does anybody want to set up a date for sheep hunting in Siberia?
I'm game.
I could say lots of things about maybe finding sheep closer to home, but I won't.
All right. Thanks so much for your time, guys.
Take care.
It is a safe bet that one of the greatest sports rivalries in America is the one between Michigan and Ohio State. Well, there's a Beat Michigan campaign happening right now in Buckeye land that even the most diehard Wolverine fan could not complain about. A 12-year-old Ohio State fan has been fighting brain cancer for the past 2 years. And to get him through the grueling chemo to help him marshal every bit of energy toward beating that cancer, young Grant Reed has named his tumor Michigan. And guess what? It's working. Plus, there's nothing like some internet fame to take a kid's mind off the tough realities of a cancer battle. Joining us from Columbus, Ohio, is Grant's dad, Troy Reed. Hello, Troy.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. I just did a quick Google search, Troy. And as of this afternoon, this story of Grant naming his tumor Michigan shows up over 2,300 times, and it just came out. Did you ever expect this much attention to Grant and his Michigan campaign?
Never. Not in a million years. We did a local story, just kind of as a feel-good piece, really, for the kids that are still here fighting to show that, you know, yes, you can beat this disease, and, you know, never expecting it to air worldwide.
And you are right. It is worldwide. And I think we should set the stage here by saying it is very fair to say that your boy really is a lifelong Buckeye fan, because it goes back to you and your wife, doesn't it?
It does. My wife and I were both members of the Ohio State University Marching Band when we were in college. It's where we met. I actually proposed to her at the halftime of the Ohio State-Michigan game in 1994, which coincidentally, the whole time we were in the marching band, was the only time that we ever beat Michigan. So we had a really good day that day. It was wonderful for us. But he has been brought up knowing that every Saturday in the fall is football Saturday, and the world kind of stops for a few hours while we watch the Buckeyes play.
So, Troy, tell us, where and how did the idea of naming the tumor Michigan come from?
Well, when Grant was diagnosed, his oncologist came into the room after we had gotten admitted to the hospital and started talking to him about the tumor and about cancer, and he really didn't want anything to do with talking about it. I think in an 11-year-old's mind, that life and death discussion is something that they just don't want to have, and I can't say I blame him.
Sure.
So she decided, you know, she talked to us for a little bit, and she's like, you know what, Grant, we can't talk about this if we can't call it something. She goes, so your goal for the night is to figure out what you want to name this and come up with something that we can call it so that when we talk, we know that's what we're talking about. So she left, and that evening we were sitting around his bed playing a board game, and he kind of stopped and looked at his mom and I, and he's like, I know what I want to call it. And we're like, well, what's that? And he goes, I want to call it Michigan. And we're like, really? Well, why is that? And he goes, because. He goes, Ohio State always beats Michigan. And obviously he didn't live through the years we did. But but he, you know, and in fairness, I think, you know, his mom and I talked about it, and it was an excellent choice because, you know, you have that rivalry, and for him to be able to put it into terms he can understand, you know, watching football every Saturday, that it's a competition, it's a battle. You go out there and you fight, and if you want to win, you have to do the work to get there, and you have to prepare, and you have to be mentally tough and strong to win the game. And I think that put it into a term that he could understand, that is something, it's a fight he's going to have to battle. And you don't have a rivalry because you beat them every year. And you don't have a rivalry because you lose every year. You have a rivalry because you split the difference, and sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. And I think a pretty good synonym for what cancer is. You know, it's a battle that you always want to win, but not everybody gets to. So I thought, you know, his mother and I thought that that was a very apt term to call it.
So it really marshaled his fighting spirit. How did the OSU team support him?
They've been great. Actually, Ohio State as a whole, the whole athletic department has been phenomenal. We've had, you know, several players came and visited him during his treatments. Coach Meyer has come in and visited him. You know, the hockey team sent a signed hockey stick. You know, the girls' basketball team sent a ball. The men's basketball team sent a poster. It's just been amazing the amount of support that he's garnered from Ohio State.
And what has it meant to Grant and to you and your wife as his story has made its way around the world? What has that meant for him?
It's been awesome. You know, we got readmitted. His last chemo was last Friday. He got to ring the victory bell, which was an awesome thing for his mom and I to see. But the next day, unfortunately, he developed a fever and, you know, he came back in and was readmitted on Saturday with a bacterial infection, bloodborne bacterial infection. But we've got that under control. But it has meant sitting in the hospital for, you know, several days now with nothing to do. So this has been a nice diversion for him because he can see himself on the internet and he can Google images of Grant Reed and Google, you know, his name and see all these different stories. Like you said, a couple thousand different articles on him now. It's been fun for him. You know, when ESPN Sports Center put his story on their Facebook page, it got, I think, 62,000 likes, and he thought that that's just super cool. So it has given him a nice diversion to think about something other than just sitting here.
I noticed, Troy, as I was checking out the stories, typical reader comments to stories being published about Grant, and there was Michigan fans like a fellow named Tyler Ross, and he wrote, "I'm a Michigan sports fan. I feel so proud to be part of the greatest rivalry in all of sports. It's safe to say this is the only time I'll find myself hoping for an Ohio State win. My heart and prayers are with Grant and his family." What do words like that mean to you?
You know, I have to say, Michigan fans have been a class act about this. You know, from Coach Hoke all the way down, we've garnered so much support from Michigan fans, and so many of my friends that are Michigan fans even, you know, say, "You'll never hear me say this again, but I hope he beats Michigan." You know, for something like this, everyone can come together and put aside some differences on the field and just care for a young man who's battling a terrible disease.
Well, we may be a service of the University of Michigan, but we too can say at least this once, we are very glad that Grant and Ohio State are beating Michigan.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that so much.
Troy Reed, his 12-year-old son Grant, a true OSU fan, is beating his brain cancer, a tumor that he has named Michigan. Best of luck to Grant and to you and your wife, Troy.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it so much.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Tony Brown. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock.